Actually, why don't you pull that up? Good morning, everyone, and thank you for being here. My name is Casey McCormick, and I'm a PhD candidate in cultural studies here at McGill University. I'm also the social media coordinator for the Future Humanities Project, so I've been emailing and or tweeting with many of you over the past several months and looking forward to meeting you all in person over the next 2 days. As social media coordinator, I also want to start by asking those of you who will be tweeting the conference events to please use the hashtag #FutureHumanities so that we can sustain a consistent back channel and archive the tweets after the conference. But I'm here today to introduce our first plenary session, which is the result of a brainstorm among a coalition of graduate students from the various universities participating in our conference. And I'd like to thank Paul Yakin for giving us this opportunity to set the tone for the conference with this session and hopefully lay out a framework for the issues that we'd like to see addressed and the goals that we'd like everyone to strive for over the course of the next 2 days. So we are a caucus of about 30 graduate students from roughly a dozen universities in Canada. And we spent several hours yesterday afternoon and into the evening sharing our ideas, our concerns, and our struggles as graduate students in the humanities. We then attempted to organize these ideas into a format that would make sense for this session, trying to figure out which issues were most important, which ones we needed to address this morning, and perhaps most importantly, how to turn the problems that we're identifying into potential solutions. The conversations were rich and productive. But as much as we would love to be able to present to you a clear and optimistic vision for the future of humanities, we did find ourselves coming up a bit short in terms of the concrete strategies for enacting the kinds of change that I think most people in this room know needs to happen. So while we don't want to start this conference off on a bleak note, one of the big takeaways from our experience yesterday is that things are indeed a bit bleak. I think we know that. But I do think that it's worth working through some of these specific problems in hopes that over the course of the next few days, we, graduate students, faculty, administrators, post-academics, non-academics, so that we can all really start to nail down how to transform and reform humanities graduate education in order to secure its future. So what we've done is organize this session into two roundtable groups, each with four speakers from our coalition, and each speaker is going to talk for 5 minutes on a specific facet of that roundtable topic. After those four mini talks, other members of our graduate student caucus, who are in the first two rows here, will pose questions and comments to the speakers. With the remaining time, we'll then open up to the rest of the audience for further questions and comments. We'd also like to let you know that we posted some of the notes from our extended discussion yesterday. They're on the Future Humanities website. I posted them this morning. They're also circulating on Twitter because we realized that we're not going to be able to hit all of the points that we wanted to in this 90 minutes. So we do hope that you'll view that document and keep those points in mind in addition to the things that we bring up this morning throughout the conference. So. Okay.
Aha.
So what we've done is framed the roundtable topics as what we are calling provocations. And so the first one of these is that humanities graduate programs lack transparency and accountability. So I'd like to invite our four speakers for this provocation. We've got Nadia Porin, Carenza Sutton-Bennett, Sarah Manya, and Robert Brown. So please join us up here. And then when we're done with this, we're going to move on to the second group, which will be starting with the provocation that the humanities need to engage beyond the academy. And my colleague, Eliza Bateman, who I should have probably introduced a moment ago, has been my co-organizer of the Graduate Student Caucus. We'll take over from there. All right, thank you. So yes, we'll start with Nadia. Oh, you can actually, if you want to come up here, you can, or you can sit and talk with the mic. Prefer here? Okay.
Hi. Okay, so the first topic that we want to address is that of mentorship.
So as graduate students, we each have a thesis supervisor who is able to walk us through the process of the thesis, which includes a lot of different tasks. But in order to prepare for the job market, we believe both an academic job market and a non-academic job market, we believe that we require further mentorship. So this would be not just mentoring through the thesis, but ideally would be a broader way to mentor through the entire program and even prepare for a specific career. And we recognize that the thesis supervisor is not always the one who is best suited to do that, though it seems that that has kind of been put to the thesis supervisor. This may be due to, frankly, a lack of interest or perhaps also due to having interest but not really being familiar with a particular career choice that a student has. Some departments within the humanities have started to address this. Some have specific faculty positions, such as a job liaison, in which this person will interview new academics in the field and also speak to individuals who are working inside of academia as well as outside. And that person acts as a resource for the whole graduate department, and that's done at the department level. they collect all this information, and they can provide it to students who are interested in receiving it. And one benefit to this is that, to some extent, it then becomes specific to the student's department, and then as a result of this, it is specific to their broad field of study. A little more generically, stepping away from that level of specificity, some recent documents, such as the white paper, have made steps to address the gap in academic mentorship by proposing mentorship with the private sphere. There are also initiatives at a number of universities, some of which are student-led, others of which are not, which develop workshops and short-term teaching modules to focus on different professional development skills, which also do, we recognize, help prepare students for various jobs, both inside and outside of academia. And these are good initiatives, but they cannot, or at least they are not, covering all of the benefits that could come from receiving long-term, individual, discipline-specific mentorship. And we don't have a concrete vision of what form this kind of mentorship might take. For example, would students have an option to be paired with one specific mentor? Might there be a committee of mentors in the way that there is for a thesis committee who could offer different perspectives and draw from different experiences? Would these mentors be faculty members? Would they be from the private sphere? Would it be a combination of this? We also wonder if there would be a way to acknowledge the time that would be taken up by mentorship, because we recognize it is a time commitment. We know that there is a comparable time within thesis supervision as there would be with mentorship, so we wonder if there might be able to administratively acknowledge the time that would be given to mentors. Because although we would hope that mentorship would be fulfilling for both sides, as on the student as well as the mentor, we do recognize that there are very real time constraints on everyone's schedule. There are many benefits to mentorship. One of the long-term ones is preparing for a job. So we think that individual mentorship would, of course, help prepare graduate students for life after graduate studies. But in order to take steps towards one's desired career, we do need to have specific mentoring advice along the way. But it would also greatly improve life in the present moment as a graduate student. So, for example, a lot of graduate students want more detailed feedback that may fall outside the realm of a thesis supervision. They may want feedback on a grant proposal or a subsequent grant rejection, or how to incorporate their work within the broader academic discussion. And this may not fall under the thesis supervisor's area of specialty. The last point that we want to note about this idea of mentorship is that it would follow a transformative model rather than an imitative model. So we would not be trying to replicate a specific mentor's role of what they have done within their own job career, but we would allow students to go with their own particular desires and kind of work from that. So that's what we have to say about mentorship.
For every grad student, there are lots of demands and requirements to fulfill. One thing that affects all grad students at some point in their grad student tenure is funding. I know this is something that has been talked about for many years and something that will continue to be a concern. Something that we need as grad students is the ability to be able to do our studies without constantly worrying whether we'd be able to pay rent and if we can have food. Right now, there is also concerns in regards to the length of time that it takes to complete a PhD. I know this is something that is being discussed across the board. And part of what impacts that is the need to get external jobs as grad students because our funding does not cut it. So that's something that is troubling and also something that we need to deal with on a day-to-day basis. Another issue is in regards to international students. Universities accept these wonderful students that are outside of Canada, but a lot of times they are unable to give them funding or partial funding. And that is a frustration that we see that our cohorts are struggling and that after their first or second year, that they're needing to either transfer schools or they have to leave the program to go back to their own countries. And that's frustrating because we see that these wonderful, brilliant people are having to leave a program because they have no money. Another thing that we see is that there's inconsistency in funding, that some schools have funding for the summer and other schools don't. And when schools don't have funding in the summer for students, that means students have to go out and find external jobs, which takes away times from studying from comps, from writing their thesis, and for being able to continue their studies, which in turn can make the length of the thesis and the PhD process longer. In regards to solutions, we came up with a few different ideas. One of them was in regards to funding, in regards to cost estimates that we see in all different university websites that take a look and say, you know, this is how much it will cost for you to go to school. As a grad student, we all discussed this and felt that they weren't accurate and that there should be more realistic because as a grad student, when you're deciding to go to university, you have to take into all of those things into account. And at times there can be surprises when you think, okay, I'll have enough money with funding. And then when you get to the university, you find out that it's more expensive or you get to the university and find out that rent and food in the city that you have chosen is a lot more expensive. So that's something that we thought that maybe that grad students could be polled, could be asked on a more regular basis, have a communication with university admin, so that can be a realistic idea. Also, we talked about that obviously we know that there are budget cuts, that there are budget crises within universities, but having a funding within the departments which is based on financial need, not academic merit. Because again, if somebody needs more funding, perhaps they could have the ability to apply for that. And this is something that we really also want to see more transparency and more accountability when it comes to funding. It is also something that as students, we talk among ourselves and one person is told that there's no funding and then another person gets a lot of funding. So that's something that we would like to have an idea of the range. A lot of universities will say, you know, we fund a minimum of 15,000 or a minimum of 20,000 a year, but they don't really explain how they come about that number. And it would be really great to sort of get that idea and also to be able to know what we're getting into because we want to be successful. We want to be able to complete our degrees. And one final point, too, is also a lot of issues when it comes to funding. It's for 4 years. And realistically, that is difficult to finish a thesis in 4 years. So we would like to, if there is funding for a fifth year, so that we don't end up getting external jobs or teaching, which is a wonderful experience, but that also takes away time from us to be able to write our thesis, which means we will be there longer. So I'm sorry we don't have a lot of solutions when it comes to funding, but hopefully this will give some ideas to discuss and something that us as grad students would love to work with university admin and sort of discuss ways that we can improve this going forward. Thank you.
Good morning. So we just heard about a few issues, and I would like to talk about a potential solution or system for a solution. We spent hours yesterday discussing the issues, and we could have spent days discussing the issues. It took us some time to parse out what we were going to speak to you about today, and this points to one clear need, which is to continue the conversation. So one of the things that we would like to suggest as a very concrete solution is a way to continue the conversation. And that is, at the end of this conference, to create a space, whether that is virtual and or also face-to-face, but to create a space where people can connect. And this is A, for the necessity, and B, strength in numbers. And this is one of the things that we did find, is that we are all interested in keeping on with this conversation. So what is this new thing? It's a very theoretical term, thing. We're thinking of it as a new think tank. So a place not only to build a network and to network among each other, but also to exchange ideas and look at some strategies not only for survival, but for life outside of the university, strategies for looking for work. We heard some great strategies yesterday with Anne. And one of the things that I wanted to mention particularly is that this group should be not only inclusive of people who are current students, but people who are alums. And I know that I've done a study recently tracking humanities graduates and speaking, interviewing some of them directly. And I was extremely surprised at how many of them were willing to connect with me instantly via Facebook, via LinkedIn, and wanted to join the current student network at Concordia for my department, which means there is not another network, and I'll speak to the specific study that I did, but there is not another network that exists where we can join each other. I think this should be a national network. It has the possibility to be an international network, and we're looking at it as a place where people can exchange ideas, radical or conventional, all of those things together. There was the suggestion yesterday that this also could be a working group at Congress. That's a very concrete suggestion. I think it's also possible that this could start very grassroots and simple, a Facebook page, a Twitter feed. We all know the importance of social media. I've just been given my two-minute mark, so I would like to say that we would like your feedback on this as well. And if you're some social media expert here, or you've got an idea of an existing network that could be expanded, please talk to us. We're going to have a moment for questions as soon as we're done with all of us up here. And I think it's important to continue the conversation. Okay, thank you.
So in a pretty problematic way, where we're seeing a lot of these problems surface is now and immediately in issues regarding mental health. We can kind of joke about it and we can kind of throw it off that we all, as PhD students at one time or another, have gone through some sort of formative trauma that has been essential to the completion of our degree and our development of academic identities. If we get past the joke about it, the fact is that we are naturalizing these traumas. We're naturalizing a lack of mental health in the academy. The difficulty is that we've got decreased aspects of prospects of employment, increased times and commitment demands by interdisciplinary programs, and with professionalization. We're working under crippling debt. There is, as one of the members from our working group suggested, an increased precarity of precarity. more graduate students are suffering from mental health issues as this. They range from imposter syndrome, feelings of isolation, insecurity, infantilism, issues of identity, substance abuse, and in the most severe cases, self-harm and suicide. And they're issues that we all know about. We all know that they exist, but they continue going forward through conditions of neglect, denial, and pervasive silence. Now, what I want to suggest is a series of suggestions that have been made by through academic affairs, inside higher ed, and what happened here in our working group and what we are seeing within the student body. The cost is really quality of life. It sounds so ridiculous to have to say that students need to sleep, that they need to eat, that they need to take breaks, they need to exercise, and they need to put post-material needs ahead of their academic needs at times. It seems really, really simple, but we are working 60 hours a week, and not to even speak on the kind of pervasive ruminations that we always have going through our minds, that pencil and pad you're always carrying around to jot down notes, work it out. Many of us are concerned that the increased demand for professionalization has led to or is perceived as a loss of collegiality. That if corporate culture in the institutions are being used to further legitimize social withdrawal and isolation. There's the concern that the current narrative of academic development often favors singular models of ideal academic development. There's not a transformative model for a student-to-student basis and what that might look like. There's also a great concern that our academic work in the humanities lacks real, tangible meaning. There's also what we saw yesterday was a deep apathy about even this event itself. Will this be so many words without any real results? And then the suggestion here is that there needs to be a program in place where students can get or work through self-help and self-care. We need to relearn how to be successful academics, not as undergrads that are neurotically obsessing about one thing, but how to work in healthy ways. Now, we also need to be able to address that access to mental health can't be seen as a weakness, that in highly competitive departments that this doesn't make us a lesser person because we need to access this resource. We also have that know that faculty are not trained to see the indicators of this. And there needs to be some training in this regard for faculty to be able to identify the signs of isolation. And as one final note, and this comes out of our discussions that we had at York, we see a trend that people are realizing the quality and the value of their degree, the strengths of their degree, only after they've finished their degree. And there needs to be a movement to realize these abilities and these strengths while we're doing our PhDs instead of after them. So thank you very much.
Okay, thank you all very much. We're now going to start by opening up to questions and comments from our graduate student caucus, and then we will take some more questions as well. So who'd like to start?
Just speaking to the final point, Robert, would you say that one of the challenges, or at least one of the challenges I see in terms of mental health issues is programs that are directed specifically at grad students? And maybe you could speak a little bit more to, I think there are lots of mental health programs in universities that are broadly targeted, but that it can sometimes be challenging for grad students to go to a group on anxiety with a student that they teach. And maybe speaking a bit more to that need.
I'm not an expert on the issue. I'm kind of just more of a talking head for this. But Looking at a lot of the research last night, it seemed that this is directly the case, that there is a lot of openness at the undergrad level, and we don't have the same openness to access these resources at the graduate level. There was no suggestion as to why that is, but I think we can all speculate that this would be one of them. You wouldn't want to see your undergrad students. You wouldn't want to see your colleagues either, I think. You wouldn't want to be put in that position where you feel like you're a lesser academic, or it's a sign of weakness when there is high stakes and high competition, and if we don't have the kind of support networks and collegiality that we need to go forward. So.
Just following up on that point, and I think it does tie into funding, right, in terms of who has access to mental health care. And because of the stigma around mental health and that you need to be the ideal student, you need to be strong and you need to be able to handle it, to handle the high pressure nature of the work, a lot of students may not recognize that they are living in crisis and that they may need support. And so even if they have health benefits, they may not know where to go. They may not know, even though every university has counseling development centers, there is that stigma of walking through the door and admitting that, right? So I like the point of having faculty members be able to identify signs or being able to talk, or like the supervisor to be able to be that kind of medium point, right? That kind of entry point to where can you go for help if you need help. And it is about stigma. It's reducing the stigma around mental health, I think, is really important. But also it ties into the stresses around lack of funding and et cetera. So anyway.
Hi. It's interesting that you end with the mental health issue, because I remember very much a little bit after our main discussion, we sat around in a more collegial sort of way, and three or four or five people were going, and what about this? Yeah, that's mental. And what about this? Yeah, that's mentally challenged. And yes, and this does it, and this does it, and it's ending. The three people who perhaps spoke beforehand laid that up very nicely into a very cogent thing. And I think that's the thing with accountability. I'm interested in that whole sense that, you know, this network that we talk about, how it is perceived by students as being this network of communication between administrators and the students, not on health issues of mental health. That is the result, in a sense, of the general problems in accountability and et cetera. When do we know that the funding for experiential sorts of projects are in fact available? There are some funds that come out, for example, that could give us great experience, that could give us great new ideas for how this university can continue, and we don't know about them as students. And that's the key, I think, with the network, too, is the establishment of communications between university administration and students. You mentioned that you were talking with former students, and I wonder what their perception of that communication was, in league with the idea that the general question was, is there something like that now? And everybody knew that there was a student union nationally, and yet we've not heard.
Just to be clear about your question, it is, what is the reaction from students in terms of a network? I have to say that that was not a question that I asked the students that I spoke to. The sense that I had from them was that they were very interested in contact, and that was for a number of reasons. Differences in paths. I spoke to people who, some were in tenure track positions, some had started their own companies with interests and backgrounds that came directly out of the PhD, and they were geographically very dispersed. So I think that is the other issue, is that once you leave a community, you're in a different community. You may be in a different university community, but you have some thread, at least, of common experience from the department or place that you came from. The network that I'm suggesting, we're suggesting, is beyond individual departments. It's also beyond administration and graduate student associations. And I think there was a consensus that GSAs in general are not the place to expand this network, to be frank about that. I hope I've answered your question. Okay.
I just have a quick question from this prime position, because yesterday we were speaking, to Sarah's point, but also to Nadia's, about the mentoring, the idea of a mentoring program, and also this alumni and student network. And I'm wondering whether, I'd like your thoughts on whether that's possibly something that could be merged or at least put together, that maybe an alumni, professional alumni, actually working in an outreach capacity, or if not outreach, maybe a part-time role at the university, might meet that need better than a permanent member of faculty?
That sounds great.
Do you want to...
Yeah, that sounds wonderful. I don't know about the feasibility of it because we've not yet looked into those details, but that does sound like a very ideal situation.
Okay. I think we have a question back there.
Yeah, I think that's me.
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you for doing all of this together, because I think it's so important to see all of these issues being brought out at the same time, because you begin to see the ways in which all of them are related. And one of the things that I've noticed is that you tweak something in a program and you break something else in the process. So, for instance, we radically shrunk the size of our PhD program in order to increase funding, but then we radically shrunk the size of our cohort. And made it difficult for them to find, for our students to find the kind of support they need to make it through they don't have the social life that they need to make it through their program. Mm-hmm. Likewise, you up the amount of professionalization you do, you increase the workload of students, you increase their anxiety levels, you create more mental health issues. And so these sort of systems are all related, and I think a kind of overall systems analysis would be really, really helpful, because it's so easy to play with one piece of the puzzle and then to really cause a problem somewhere else. And so I think that it's really useful to hear all of these things staged in one place.
I'd just like to echo those thanks and to appreciate you for speaking so frankly about the challenges that you encounter on a day-to-day basis. Just a few quick comments, again, emphasizing the integrated nature of many of these challenges. I appreciate to the focus in the comments that have been posted on international students, which in many of our universities make up about 20 to 22% of our graduate student cohort, and I'm glad that it's made so prominently a chief position in these discussions. Just picking up on the last comments about mental health, and I really appreciate the emphasis on social isolation. There was a study that was reported widely in the Times Higher Education Supplement a couple months ago, based on the University of Exeter's finding that something like 48% of PhD students found the social isolation had pretty major repercussions on mental well-being. And I wonder if there's a way of connecting that to the discussion that we've had through the CAGS and SHRC roundtables about looking at collaborative research models and seeing if there is work to be done there on the humanities side. Another point, I think so many universities have primarily an undergraduate focus in their mental health work, and at Queen's, and I know a few other institutions have had have this now in place too. We were the beneficiary of a sizable donation that makes it possible for us to have a counselor embedded in the School of Graduate Studies, specifically doing programming for graduate students in mind, and I think that that's one step forward. And what we're trying to do to redress the social isolation is have more writing retreats, but we have so far to go really in this area, so thank you for raising these issues.
Uh, Triple the thanks. But I also want to raise a concern. Those of us who supervise and are cast in the role of mentor to doctoral students received no training in that job. And we do it by trial and error, and in many cases we do it as we were done, and that's not a good idea. But I guess I'd throw out back to you, not as a question that we can answer right this moment, but a question to the graduate students about the degree to which they are asking for, demanding, explicit attention to the role of supervision, since it will be, if you're lucky enough to get an academic position, one of your most important jobs. So it would be good for graduate students to be asking of their departments, what support are you giving us so that we can go forth and do this job maybe better than you've done it for us?
Yeah, I just wanted to thank you for that comment, and I wanted to tell y'all that yesterday when we decided that transparency and accountability was going to be one of our umbrella terms, there was a lot of discussion about how that works both ways, and that it's equally, the onus is equally on the graduate students to be transparent and accountable to express their problems, and in that way we start to establish a kind of back and forth of transparency. So it goes both ways, so I appreciate that comment.
Got our mic.
Yep, they're on their way.
Oh,
okay.
Oh, I have this.
So. Oh, you have one. Okay. Go ahead.
A quick comment and a question. One of the things that I think connects all of this is a sense, how can I put this, that I was the world's oldest graduate student, so it's very recent in memory, that graduate students are often looked at by undergraduates as professors. Mm-hmm. And so not only does one need the specialized help for as Anthony points out, the knowing how to be supervised, but one is also often asked to supervise or has a duty of care towards undergraduates, which many professors feel, but without the training. So I think one of the things that is implicit here but might want to be addressed with all of this is the notion that a graduate student is looked at and often used as a mentor without the training. So it's not just receiving supervision, but giving supervision. And since, in theater we talk about imitation all the time, it's not just an imitative thing, as you pointed out, it's transformative. So how do you get that specialized training? Should it be something that goes with an information officer or someone for all graduate students, or should it be discipline specific? But certainly the need is there to give and take supervision. Would you not agree?
Just to respond to that, I think that's also one of the main reasons why we do need more open dialogue amongst graduate students, but also with other networks, because we can learn from each other, we can share our own mistakes, fears, successes, you know, all of that. So that would also be something that hopefully with a broader network that we would be able to support and encourage and challenge each other as graduate students as we're even in that role of mentorship.
Gentleman in the back.
Thanks. Just going to yell. Thank you for the panel. It's been very helpful. I have a question about, in your discussions, do you feel that there's a distinction to be made between professionalization on the one hand, that, say, a department might look after, and mentorship on the other? Or if you see this fundamentally overlapping in how we might approach this question of helping graduate students prepare both during and after.
So just to repeat for those who are on the live stream, the question here is about the overlap or relationship between professionalization and mentorship.
I think there definitely is overlap, but one of the questions that we have is also recognizing that not any one individual could offer, well, maybe someone is a superstar, but probably not any one individual could offer advice in all of those areas. So maybe looking at a more like a committee model of mentorship, maybe informally, not having a formal structure to it, but being able to draw from some professors might be able to offer advice in the area of professional development. Others might know the job market very well and could offer advice on how to prepare for that. And we don't really know how this will look yet, I guess, but definitely there would be overlap in different areas.
Is this on?
Yeah. Just a question to you guys before I take it to the panel. Have you told people not to identify themselves? Are we under a cone of anonymity here or anything like
not
that?
Not at all. It's an accidental cone.
Okay. I just thought it would be helpful if we all knew who we all were. So I'll start. I'm Noreen Goffman of Memorial University. Thank you. Don't want to be bossy pants here or anything like that. Robert, I have a question for you. Totally innocent. No agenda here. But I just would like to hear more about how either or both commercialization and professionalization leads to decreasing collegiality, I think you said, or I'm paraphrasing, and isolation. Could you say more about that? Why?
I don't think it needs to be a necessary effect of it, but I think it's just the general perception, and this is completely anecdotal of what I've seen across departments and what we were also talking about in our larger group, was that I don't know that I think it's just a preconception of what professionalization must be. I don't think that we have a good conceptual apparatus to say what professionalization is going to look like in the humanities, and I don't think it often reflects very well the strengths, the core strengths of the humanities when it goes into professionalization. So we're adopting a language without making it our own, essentially, and the effects on the graduate population is that it gives you a bit of an out. You know, like if I professionalize, then I can give up certain other things because now I can be a professional. I can be this style of academic instead of this other style of academic.
We probably have time to field one more question before moving on to the second segment of this. I saw this hand first. Maybe we can work in your question to the next.
Which hand?
Yeah,
okay. Sorry.
It's an option.
Hi, I'm Nikki Agate with the Modern Language Association, and I'm actually curious what you guys see as the role that a scholarly society or a disciplinary society can do with for some of this professionalization, mentorship, the other issues you've brought up.
I think maybe the best starting point is transparency. So we recognize for things like mental health, for mentorship, for all of these things we've brought up, we recognize that people may not be able to provide these ideal roles that we're kind of tossing out into the air here. But if we begin with transparency, so for example, if there's an issue of mental health that arises, though a professor may not be able to identify that, if we at least know that there is an openness or that there is an environment within a department for someone to bring awareness to that, that would be a good starting point. I think we recognize that within the scholarly world there is a limited amount of there's a limitation on what people can offer and what people can address. We're trained as academics, not as, you know, mentors or psychiatrists or any of that. But I think we were in agreement yesterday that transparency is a very good starting point.
And I think in regards to funding, just having open discussions about that and being able to talk about it as students and be able to feel that they can talk to someone, either from a professional group or to the administrative, something like that, instead of feeling that you're just going to have a closed door, that it's automatically going to be told, no, there's no more funding, and to be able to have a place, especially for international students, for them to be able to go somewhere and say, I'm struggling, I need help. And I think that also plays into the mental aspect to it as well. We're talking about isolation. Well, you know, those students feel isolating, but also we're talking about like smaller cohorts. Well, you know, if you're looking at a class that has three or four cohorts and then two have to drop out, that's isolating for those people that are remaining. So while it's not obviously the same effect of those who don't have the funding and have to drop out, the remaining people, that can have a mental impact as well on them.
So thanks so much, everybody, and thanks to our first panelist. We really appreciate it.